I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Ballot Talks on Radio Times. With Republicans winning both houses of Congress last year and the next presidential campaign in full swing, you might think that President Obama would be out of the spotlight. You would be wrong.
My presidency is entering the fourth quarter. Interesting stuff happens in the fourth quarter, and I'm looking forward to it.
Because of this deal, the international community will be able to verify that the Islamic Republic of Iran will not develop a nuclear weapon.
For nonviolent drug crimes, we need to lower long mandatory minimum sentences or get rid of them entirely.
Racism, we are not cured of. And it's not just a matter of it not being polite to say nigger in public.
Removing the flag from this state's capital would not be an act of political correctness. It would not be an insult to the valor of Confederate soldiers. It would simply be an acknowledgement that the cause for which they fought, the cause of slavery, was wrong.
So the Trans-Pacific Partnership that we're working on, it's the highest standard, most progressive trade deal in history.
Today, I can announce that the United States has agreed to formally reestablish diplomatic relations with the Republic of Cuba and reopen embassies in our respective countries.
Yesterday at his press conference, Obama vigorously challenged critics of his nuclear weapons deal with Iran and said he wanted to make sure their criticisms had been addressed. Presidents don't typically ask for critical questions from the press. Today we talk about Obama's recent domestic and foreign policy achievements and what they might mean for his legacy. And we have two guests who have joined us. Ryan Graham is Washington bureau chief for the Huffington Post and an MSNBC contributor, author of a book called This Is Your Country on Drugs. And Ryan Graham, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us is Julian Zelizer. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, the author of several books, including most recently, The Fierce Urgency of Now. And Julian Zelizer, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Julian, let me begin with you, and whether you agree with Obama or you or anyone else agrees with Obama's policies or not, it seems like he's been having a pretty successful run in the last couple of weeks. You think this is coincidence, a kind of confluence of events, a payoff for some of these policies he's pursued?
Yeah, look, he has used his executive power very effectively in the last few months. And that's one area where the president can circumvent Congress. He's gone overseas and with Secretary Kerry worked out an important area of diplomatic agreement. We'll see how it unfolds in Congress. And he's gotten some help from the Supreme Court on a series of pretty big cases where that's not so much about Obama. It's about the court pushing forward his agenda, sometimes unexpectedly. You know, the one place he broke through Congress was a trade agreement.
That's
but
right.
I think that will remain controversial because many Democrats are still not fully comfortable with that deal.
How do you see this, Ryan?
I think that he actually even deserves credit for the marriage equality ruling that came out. That was the court that kind of put the finishing touches on it. But if you could do a counterfactual where the president had not come out in support of gay marriage, it's very difficult to see the debate kind of swinging as quickly as it did in the final moments. I don't think the Supreme Court would have put its stamp of approval on it with the president still saying that he was for civil unions. Now, of course, as everybody seems to know, the president has been for marriage equality probably for at least a decade, if not more. But he was kind of saying he wasn't for political reasons. But him finally coming out and saying, okay, look, yes, I support gay marriage, that, I think that swung it. And so that adds to the sense of momentum that you're talking about.
Ryan, do you think he was outed by his vice president, though, on the issue of gay marriage?
Sort of. I think he came forward, a month or two earlier. I think he wanted to make a bigger splash with it. He wanted to, give a big speech and go public and do it his way. Instead, he had to do it kind of Joe Biden's way, but only by a month or two, I think.
Julian, I don't know whether or when the lame duck session officially begins for a president. And I don't know if it's the last couple of months in office or whether it depends on the president or Congress or facts on the ground. Are we in the lame, sort of a weird lame duck session or not?
Well, there's no real official period when that happens. It could be the last 2 years. It could be the last 2 months. But what we do know is presidents can often do a lot of things in the final few years. Even Jimmy Carter made some big moves protecting the wilderness. President Reagan made a lot of moves overseas, including with the INF agreement in his final 2 years. That was the agreement with the Soviet Union. So the term lame duck doesn't actually capture what the executive is able to do and the Congress he works with in the final years.
Do you think Obama's feeling some sense of the fierce urgency of now, Julian?
He is. Look, yeah, he had a very successful first few years, and then a Congress that turned Republican in 2010 didn't give him much leeway for legislation. And I think he realizes, and this is part of why there's an urgency in the final years, that he has to use every ounce of juice that he has to get things through right now, or to use other powers to get things through. So I do think he wants to leave his mark. I think he's working as hard as he can, even though the Republicans in Congress, other than trade, still aren't really willing to work with him.
Well, it's interesting, Ryan, to look at what happened when he first came into office, and there was a Democratic majority in Congress, and obviously the country was in a serious financial crisis at the time. But to compare and contrast the very beginning of his presidency and the last, 18 months or so.
Well, sure, and those 2 years, 2009 and 10, are going to go down as some of the most productive legislative years, in the course of a century. You have to kind of go back to, Lyndon Johnson and FDR before that. With FDR, it also followed a financial crisis, and then, as was mentioned, he lost his majorities, and there were kind of some lost years that followed where he and John Boehner, were both struggling. Obama probably harder than Boehner to try to find some sort of compromise or some common ground on a grand bargain or anything else that he could get done. At heart, the president is very much a conciliatory kind of guy. He wants to find compromise. He has called himself in various settings, a blue dog Democrat at heart, or even in the past maybe a liberal Republican, but he didn't get anything. The Tea Party wing of the Republican Party shut all of that down. And so in some ways, what he has done in the last 2 years was begotten by that kind of just say no attitude that the Republican Congress took. So in other words, they sort of asked for this. He wanted to do comprehensive immigration reform, climate change, et cetera, through Congress. And that was very much his preference. And the kind of Democratic left was quite angry at him for failing to recognize the kind of nature of his opposition. And so here he is in the final 2 years kind of taking the left's advice and saying and actually just going forward and doing the things that he had hoped in the past he could get done through Congress.
Julian, looking at the Affordable Care Act, the Supreme Court upholding subsidies, and you've looked at other presidents, looked at Medicare and Medicaid, and certainly the Affordable Care Act has its critics on all sides, all political sides. How do you think, and perhaps even looking into the future, I don't know if historians can do that or not, but looking into the future, will the Affordable Care Act be seen as consequential as Medicare and Medicaid?
Yes, it will. It's bringing millions of people, obviously, through Medicaid, so the programs are related, into healthcare markets, and it's remade healthcare markets with the exchange system. There's still a question of what's going to happen in the long run with the prices for the premiums that most people pay. But if those premiums are contained, I do think this will be a major intervention, and we will talk about it in the same way we talk about the 1965 breakthrough with both Medicare and Medicaid. And, the thing about legislative breakthroughs, which were the first 2 years of the presidency, if they're not undone in the first few years, they can often stick for decades. What's more fragile about what we've seen seen in recent months, is executive actions can be undone quite easily by a Republican president. But that health care law, I think, is going to be seen as hugely consequential.
And Ryan, liberals have been particularly critical that it's not a single payer or Medicare for all, and I guess have had to sort of resolve the fact that this is the system as it exists today.
Sure, and I think the best thing that those types of critics can take from this is that it really affirmatively puts government into a place of responsibility for healthcare. And so now, if people have objections to the way that the healthcare markets are being run, they can turn to the government and say, you're not regulating this strongly enough, or these prices are out of control. You need to do something about this. Whereas before the Affordable Care Act, that wasn't the case. The people had really nowhere to turn. They were kind of just at the mercy of rising premiums, and they could maybe plead with the state insurance regulator to do something to cap the rising rates. But now the weight of the federal government is involved in this, and so that now that it has survived a couple of Supreme Court challenges, the debate moving forward is really going to be about how it's implemented and executed, rather than whether it should exist, and it will gradually encompass more and more of the healthcare system.
Ryan, since you're down there in Washington and you and the other folks at Huffington Post following the president, following what's happening in Washington, one gets the feeling that Obama has been freed up because he doesn't have to run for re-election or maybe even try to defend Democrats who were running for re-election in the 2014 races. Is there a sort of a different attitude, as we say in here in Philadelphia, that Obama seems to have?
Yeah, I think there is a different attitude, and actually, I think you can see it with the immigration order. For instance, they knew, or they sensed. I think they were wrong, but they sensed that doing an immigration order through executive action was politically toxic or problematic, and you can tell that they sensed that by the fact that they were going to do it before the 2014 midterm elections, but they pulled back because they thought there would be a blowback on their Democratic Senate candidates in red states, almost all of whom got wiped out anyway. So it's not clear that really worked. But okay, so they pulled back. They said this is politically damaging. We're not going to do it. And then after the election, they did it. So that tells you that the political calculation was kind of out the window. And I think the response, the public response has been strong enough from the Latino community, and it kind of baited the Republicans as in the way that they would expect, that it has proven politically beneficial to them. It's tied up in the courts right now. But the major point is that, yes, without the cleaver of politics hanging over them, they went ahead and they're going ahead and doing some things that they might otherwise be more worried about.
Well, we do need to take a very short break. And Julian, I want to put that to you as well, talking about President Obama. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. And he's been having a pretty good couple of months talking with Ryan Grimm. He's Washington Bureau Chief for The Huffington Post. And Julian Zelizer, Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University. I see lots of emails coming in, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. Much more after this short break. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoen. We've been talking about President Obama's big month, as we're calling it, what it could mean for his legacy. And again, Ryan Grimm is with us and Julian Zelizer. And again, lots of comments here that I do want to fold into the conversation. To you, Julian, it's so interesting to me that, an American president, or this American president, called the most powerful person in the world. And yet somehow when you don't have to run for re-election again, you become much more empowered as a president. How do you understand that?
Well, you do become empowered. I think part of what you're seeing is they just use powers they'd rather reserve until later when they've exhausted all other options. So Obama isn't more powerful in terms of Congress. It's not like all of a sudden he's moving the Republicans to pass immigration legislation. He's not moving them to pass a really pent-up legislative agenda that liberals have not been able to make any progress. What he's doing is generally giving up on that aspect of Washington. Washington, and then tapping into these executive powers that in some ways he's reserved until the very end. So part of it is empowerment. Part of it is desperation. And this is the last call. And so they are drawing on that to make these achievements.
Julian, what's that pent-up liberal agenda you're referring to?
Well, look, you know, if there was a preference on dealing with immigration through legislation or executive action, I think most immigration proponents would say legislation would be a lot better. Same with climate change, same with economic issues to deal with problems of inequality and to deal with the growing divide between the rich and the poor. These are questions that I think the next Democrat, the next Democratic president, Democratic Congress are going to want to deal with if they can. But it has not been something that has moved through Congress at this point.
How do you see that, Ryan?
Yeah, I think that's basically right. He certainly would have preferred to push all this through Congress. And like Julian said earlier, things that you put through Congress tend to last longer because, you know, President Rick Santorum or whoever comes in can't, you know, then just undo them with a stroke of a pen. Now, some of the more popular things, like the, you know, he undid Don't Ask, Don't Tell. For instance, now that actually came through Congress as well. But you know, the immigration order, you know, could be undone. Let's say the courts stamp it as legal, it could be undone by a future president. But it might not, or it might only be scaled back because of its popularity. The overtime rules, I think, you know, will be a very big deal. And your listeners might not know about this, but this could be one of the most consequential things he ends up doing for the economy in his entire 8 years. You know, he has moved the overtime threshold from around $20,000 a year to just over $50,000 a year, which means that if you earn less than $50,000 a year as a salary, then you're entitled to overtime protections, which will mean a lot of extra money in a lot of people's pockets, or it will mean raises for people. Let's say you're currently making $40,000 or $45,000 a year. It might be easier for your boss just to lift your pay up to $50,400 so that they're over that threshold. So that's a huge impact on a lot of millions of people's lives. That somebody could come in, and a new president could come in and just undo.
I mean, I what's the chance of that at least going through temporarily?
Oh, it's going to happen.
Okay.
There's a 50-day comment period, roughly. Well, it was 60 days. It's now down to probably 40 days. So it's going to happen sometime in 2016. It will be phased in. Last night there was another huge announcement that the Department of Labor is going to change the way it looks at contracting rules. In other words, you know, they're not going to let companies say that this employee is not actually an employee. They're a contractor. Let's say it's a janitor. You know, we're going to hire them as a contractor, even though this is the janitor's only job, and they are, for all intents and purposes, an employee. They're not entitled to different protections and benefits if they're dubbed a contractor. Department of Labor said yesterday, you can't do that anymore. And these are huge consequential changes that really improve the lives of millions of workers across the country, which similarly could be undone by a new president if they're not both politically protected or protected in law.
Julian, let me go back to you, and even going back to your book, The Fierce Urgency of Now. You were a guest on Radio Times talking about that book, and that looked at Johnson, President Johnson, and the civil rights legislation that he was able to get through Congress. Since we've been talking about Obama's relationship with Congress, can you compare and contrast 64, 66 to now?
Well, 64 to 66, Lyndon Johnson had the kind of Democratic majorities which President Obama would love to have. He had a little bit of it in the first couple of years. He had a Democratic majority. He had a liberal Democratic majority, and the results are clear. That was the moment he achieved many of these gains. Since 2010, that window closed for President Obama, just as the same thing happened for President Johnson after 1966. And in both cases, the legislative productivity diminished. Obama does face not only a conservative Congress, but a more right-wing Republican Party, and one I think that's been even more intent on obstruction, clearly, than the one President Johnson faced. But, you know, at the height of the Great Society, Johnson had huge liberal Democratic majorities, and they were pushing these bills left and right.
Let me throw something else in, and then we'll get to some of our comments here. This is to you, Ryan, and we've mentioned the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And this is something that Obama has been lobbying for and was able to get it through Congress with the help of the Republicans, people like Elizabeth Warren, very unhappy about this. Has that created a rift within the Democratic Party?
It certainly has, and this could be an element of the president's legacy that turns out not to be so good, depending on how things play out over the next 10 or 20 years. You know, President Clinton's legacy, you know, kind of has NAFTA around its neck. You know, the Democratic Party is pretty much united in agreeing that that NAFTA cost a lot of jobs and didn't bring the benefits that that people thought it would, as well as kind of exacerbating the drug war down there. During this debate, the backers of the Trans-Pacific Partnership were very clear to say, "Don't worry, this is not NAFTA. This is much, right, much better than NAFTA." And the others said, "No, it's not. It's just another bigger NAFTA with a lot more countries." So, you know, if that turns out to be true, then this will be something that will haunt his legacy.
What do you think, Julian?
Oh, for sure. And this is a really significant trade deal. So if this goes poorly, and if some of the critics in the Democratic Party are right, this could be as devastating to how we remember what happened as the Affordable Care Act is positive for many of his supporters. You know, this trade act gets to the heart of some of these economic problems we've been talking about. And some of his critics, the Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders wing, argue that all the gains he's made with executive power in the final few years, those will be undone if the jobs are gone. And the changes we've seen in the economy for decades now continue and accelerate because of the deal that he's made. So I think this is a really big issue. Ultimately, he won that with Republican support, more than strong, solid Democratic support, and a lot is resting on what happens.
We are talking about President Barack Obama, and at least from his perspective, a number of foreign and domestic successes, and talking with Julian Zelizer, Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University, and with Ryan Grimm, Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post. He's also an MSNBC contributor. And we're opening up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. How do you see President Obama so far? Give us a call, 1-888-477-WHYY. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Just a quick follow-up to what you said, Julian, and also, Ryan, what I'd be curious about you say as well. This week, the negotiations over the nuclear weapons program with Iran, and of course, I guess, Julian, sort of like the TPP, I guess time will tell whether what the president and his team negotiated with other countries is going to be a success or not.
Right. So obviously, at this moment, the Obama administration is praising this accomplishment as a model of the kind of diplomatic solution that he's been talking about since his inaugural address to overseas problems. And in the short term, there is going to be a lot of political fallout from this. But really, in terms of how we evaluate it, it's much too soon to have a sense of where this is going. And again, back to Reagan and the INF agreement with the Soviet Union in 1987. Also, at the time, a lot of conservatives hated it. There was a lot of questions of what was going to happen. We didn't foresee that the Soviet Union was literally going to collapse in the coming years, and this would become a model of what Reagan did right. So I think, you know, other than getting it, I think it's way too early to tell, you know, what outcome this has in the region.
And Ryan, when you look at his foreign policy over the last couple of years, it seems to be a mix of diplomacy and drones.
That's right. And, you know, he has very quietly but very dramatically scaled back the drone program in recent years, which is, you know, a good thing for people who are living under the threat of those. And that really did kind of define his outside of the killing of Osama bin Laden, his foreign policy in the early years, and that especially as drones proliferate around the world, that will probably not be looked at fondly as part of his legacy. But on the other hand, when it comes to engaging the United States in wars around the world, that has been impressive. He said he was going to leave Iraq and Afghanistan, and he did. And he did not get tangled up in the war in Syria yet, despite a lot of calls to do so. Even yesterday in his press conference, he came back to it. He said, there's not a military solution for this problem, and it's tempting to look at the chaos and all the suffering and say, U.S. troops need to do something about this. But, U.S. troops doing something, what comes next? And his point is that, this needs a political solution. And so, if that becomes kind of a lasting legacy, that will be quite impactful.
We have a comment from Kathy. She says, I'm really liking the last few months of Obama's presidency. The speech he gave yesterday at the NAACP was incredibly impressive. And, of course, he was here in Philadelphia giving that speech. I think it was actually Tuesday and not yesterday. But nonetheless, Julian, and I wanted to just add that to these two eulogies that he gave in the last month or so, one for Bo Biden in Wilmington, Delaware, a very personal speech that he gave. One got the sense of his relationship with not just Bo Biden, but Bo Biden's dad, Joe Biden. And then, of course, the eulogy in Charleston, South Carolina for Reverend Pinckney, which I thought was just an extraordinary piece of talking and of using grace and telling the story and weaving our own history in with of course, the terrible tragedy, the terrible murders that happened in Charleston, South Carolina. What do you hear the president saying?
Look, I think here he's using the power of presidential oratory, and we overestimate what presidents can do all the time. But in terms of shaping and leading national discussions on issues, I think that's one place they can have a big impact. And Obama, in some ways, has been so much more quiet than he was when he ran in 2008 on some of these big issues. He's coming back to these matters, these policies, these problems that the nation faces that have concerned him. And I think in the speeches and the eulogy you just mentioned, he is trying to lead a conversation on race, on poverty, on racial violence that isn't coming from him. I mean, it's coming from the incidents we've been watching. It's coming from the grassroots movement that's emerged in response to the police shootings. But he is taking this opportunity and trying to put them together with this great visible spot that he has. And I think he's been pretty effective.
Ryan, do you think he's been forced to talk about some of these issues because of these tragic events?
Well, I think yes. I think there's some truth to that. I think that if you remember earlier in his presidency when Professor Skip Gates was racially profiled and arrested or accosted by an officer in Cambridge on his own front porch, and the president spoke out about it. There was a huge backlash, which Obama kind of resolved with the famous beer summit.
That's right.
But he also resolved it by, it seems, resolving not to talk as much about race for the next few years. And that kind of came back with Trayvon Martin, accelerated by Ferguson, but also by the true proliferation of smartphones and video around the country. This is a real change that may be hard to remember, that just a few years ago this was not the case. And so what we're seeing now is the kind of thing that has been happening for decades around the country, except we're now seeing it. When Walter Scott was involved in what was euphemistically referred to in Charleston, South Carolina, as a, quote, officer-involved shooting, if there hadn't been video, that officer would still be patrolling the streets, the family would know that something wasn't right, but nobody else would. Instead, little to the cops' knowledge, there was somebody filming him shooting Walter Scott in the back as the unarmed man fled, and so now he's been charged with murder. And our understanding of the kind of the way that police interact with African Americans in this country has been changed. For instance, the Sandra Bland case, which is kind of tearing up the internet right now. This is a woman who was arrested by Texas police on Friday for basically she was pulled over for allegedly changing lanes without a signal, which signals to African American readers, well, that's driving while black. She was then. The police say that she gave them an attitude. So she was taken in, charged with assaulting a police officer, held in jail over the weekend, and police are now saying that she committed suicide on Monday morning. If you look at the coverage, even in Texas, it's much more skeptical. They're leading with it. There's an investigation into it, and the media in Texas, even in Texas, is quite skeptical of what happened. We don't know yet what happened, but in the past, this wouldn't be something that the whole country would be watching, and it wouldn't be something that the country was looking at suspiciously. And so in many ways, the president is kind of going where the people are here. But I would think that growing up a black man in America, it's not something that you really would have to force him to want to take on.
And Julian, we're almost up in a break here, but even going back to the speech that he gave in Charleston, he talked about slavery as the nation's original sin.
Yes. He understands the long trajectory of racial injustice in this country. But I would add, it's not simply forced. It's also responding. And it's not just the TV clips or the video clips. The Black Lives Matter movement has been really remarkable. And I think in Baltimore, that was a turning point moment, not with the violent moments, but with the protests. It actually forced action, forced the conversation. And I think the president has joined that continuum. And that's been an important development in the last few years.
And that's Julian Zelizer, Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University, the author of several books, including most recently The Fierce Urgency of Now. Ryan Grimm is with us, Washington Bureau Chief for The Huffington Post. And we are talking about President Obama, what he's been able to do and in certain cases not do in the last couple of months. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We've been talking about President Obama's very good month. The U.S. Supreme Court upheld the Affordable Care Act and also legalized gay marriage in states across the country. He got congressional support with help from Republicans for his Trans-Pacific Partnership. And on Tuesday, earlier this week, announced an agreement with Iran limiting its nuclear weapons capabilities. We've been talking about President Obama's move since the GOP took control of Congress about 6 months ago, and also what these last few weeks could mean for his legacy with Ryan Grimm and with Julian Zelizer. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. What do you think of the last couple of months of President Obama's presidency? 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Larry from Newtown to join us. Larry, go ahead. You're on the air.
All right, thank you, and thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
While I won't take away a lot of the legacy that can be attributed to President Obama's efforts, I'm very concerned about the nuclear agreement, such as it is today. Your speakers talked about the fact that in a recent comment of President Obama, the military option just doesn't exist. And I find that to be a very seductive non-starter, and that the commander-in-chief does not stand up to what's going on with Iran.
Mm.
And I find it very disappointing.
Okay, fair enough. And we actually did a whole show about that yesterday, looking at what was in this particular deal. Julian, I mean, this, as Larry indicates, and as we have said earlier, time will tell, and he's got a big fight ahead of him in Congress, it seems.
Yes. I mean, look, first, I would only disagree a bit with Larry. And this is a president who has been willing to use military force. We talked earlier about a very aggressive drone program for most of this presidency. And he's willing to deploy force. His argument is this is just a more effective way to curb the nuclear threat from Iran than continuing along the path that in his mind is unsustainable. My guess is that he and future presidents in either party would be willing to use force if necessary within the framework of this agreement. He does have a tough fight in Congress, though. The Republicans are not going to be very willing to give him the support he needs. And there are many Democrats who are uneasy privately, a few publicly, about this agreement. But he'll probably have enough votes to override a veto, get the support he needs, and move forward with the framework. And we will see what happens.
Well, and Ryan, Vice President Joe Biden, I understand, has been spending a lot of time, I guess, in Congress talking to members of his party.
Right. And what they would say to the other party is that the idea that you could, bomb Iran and solve this problem is just a pure fantasy. For one, there are more countries on the planet than just the United States and Iran. So if you game it out, if the United States launches airstrikes and let's say they obliterate most of the nuclear program, not all of it, because a lot of it's deep underground. Immediately, we become the pariah. We make Iran look like the victim, and that matters because now Europe drops its sanctions with Iran, China and Russia happily start trading with Iran again because now the geopolitics have changed, and Iran can say to the world, look, we do need nuclear weapons because, as you see, we were hit with an unprovoked attack from the United States. And so, the president, when he opposed the Iraq war, said he's not against all wars. He's against dumb wars. And he has shown, like Julian said, that he's willing to, wage a drone war, kind of all across the world. But the idea that you could solve the problem of Iran by attacking it is as silly as the problem that you could solve the issue of Iraq by invading and occupying it.
Well, and it seems, Julian, this is the legacy of the Iraq war, which ended up empowering Iran in the region.
This is one of the challenges President Obama has faced is he's constantly dealing with the fallout and problems of his predecessor. And he'll often get the blame. That happens for presidents. You can't say, well, it was the other guy. You can say that, but that's not how the electorate will often judge you. But ISIS, a lot of the other problems, you could clearly draw a line to that war launched under President George W. Bush. But again, regardless, it's been his mess to fix, so to speak.
Ryan, Obama's relationship with Congress has been described as, frosty and he doesn't seem to like to hang out with members of Congress. Has that been a problem for him? And I ask that because he did sit down with Mark Maron a couple of weeks ago in his garage, which is where he does his interviews. I don't know how the rest of the press feels about the fact that Obama gave so much time to Mark Maron, but how do you see his relationship with the press, and has that evolved at all?
It's hard to say whether a kind of more extroverted president would have had more success. He was criticized by the Republicans for not having relationships with them when he needed it to get TPP through. But they had a structural kind of coalition together that ended up winning anyway. The idea that that the president ought to be around Capitol Hill, I think the best argument for it is that a member of Congress will take a risk if he knows the president better, because it suggests then that the president is going to come to his or her defense if he or she gets in political trouble as a result of it. But beyond that, there's not much of an argument that really can be made. He came, and he's kind of so bad at lobbying the Hill that when he came to Capitol Hill to kind of lobby Democrats on the TPP, I think he actually lost votes. He came in, gave a speech to the House Democrats, and they all felt kind of insulted and said so publicly. voted him down. Like Julian said, he got it through anyway. So in the end, it's not entirely clear how much it matters.
I mean, Julian, how much do you think relationships matter in Washington between whoever the president is or this president and Congress?
I think we, tend to vastly overstate that as well. I think, you want someone who's competent, and you'd rather have a president who has a feel for Congress and who interacts well with legislators. But in the end, he's not going to win a lot of votes because he can schmooze. And, what he needed were either Republicans who were more willing to compromise or Democratic majorities. He could have schmoozed all he wanted with Speaker Boehner, and I doubt it would have changed the outcome of a single bill. I just don't think that's the way Congress works. I don't think most legislators, certainly in the current environment, are going to change their position dramatically just because they like the person in the White House. So I don't think there's much more that he could have done on that.
And Julian, even looking back in history, were presidents more able and willing to, give people bridges to nowhere and other projects or goodies in order to get some of their legislation passed?
There was some of that. And obviously, Lyndon Johnson was an example of an administration that was willing to give that kind of support for water projects, for road projects, if it might sway a vote. But in the end, even a Lyndon Johnson, even in a Franklin Roosevelt, they didn't get the numbers they needed for the big bill, Social Security, Medicare, because of that. They got it because there were sizable majorities that supported those programs, were responding to the electorate and social movements. And that's what creates atmospheres for legislative breakthrough. So with the schmoozing, we're talking about a couple votes. We're not talking about the votes necessary to move really big pieces of legislation.
Well, we are talking about President Obama with Julian Zelizer and with Ryan Grimm. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Of course, he is still president, but he's had a pretty busy couple of months. And that's what we are talking about in this hour of Radio Times. Ryan, I think the very first thing that President Obama said when he became president in 2009 was that he was going to close Guantanamo Bay. He has not been able to do that. Is that a kind of albatross around his neck?
It certainly is. And he has said that he regrets the way that he went about it. I think he says now that he wishes he would have just straight up closed it and then kind of figured out what to do with the people next, as opposed to announcing that he was going to close it within a year and then kind of allowing it to drag out and then allowing Congress to tie his hands and then drifting with his focus on it. For a long time, there wasn't even, the staffer who was supposed to be in charge of it wasn't even in place. And it just became a much more difficult project than he thought. So that's how he would see it. But it certainly is kind of continues to be a black eye for the United States and a recruiting dream for forces like the Islamic State.
Julian, want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just a counterpoint to the agreement with Iran. He made many promises when he ran. One was to use diplomacy and use it more than war. A second was to try to overturn a lot of the war on terrorism that President Bush put into place, or at least the methods that President Bush employed. And I think there, he doesn't have the strongest record. And I think many Democratic supporters of his are still uncomfortable with where things are, whether it's the failure to close Guantanamo Bay, the surveillance programs, which generally have remained in place, or even if he's drawing them down now, this very aggressive and controversial drone program. I mean, you can argue not only did he keep a lot of that counterterrorism program in place, while he cut it back with torture, he accelerated it in other areas. And we'll have to reckon with that as we look back on these 8 years.
And Ryan, one more thing about immigration. The president has been called the deporter in chief. He has had a number. I mean, I don't know what the actual number is, but many people deported under his immigration policy.
Right. And this was a political miscalculation that has caused untold amounts of pain for families across the country. It was his misguided belief that if he was as kind of brutal as he could be when it came to deporting people who were here without documents, then the Republicans would say, well, this is quite impressive. You know, and if he added to that an intense militarization of the border, which has happened. If people haven't been to the border, they might not realize it, but the border is, you know, a deeply and disconcertingly militarized place, and millions of people were deported under this president, all under the thinking that if he just did this, then the Republicans would say, oh, well, this is a guy who means business. He's tough. And so we're going to then compromise and create a pathway to citizenship for the people that haven't been deported yet, and we will accomplish comprehensive immigration reform. That was the thinking. People argued from the beginning that was a fantasy, that Republicans had their own political calculus in mind, and that there was nothing that was going to drive them to approve of a pathway to citizenship. That turned out to be true, and so all of this suffering was politically for nothing, and instead he just did it as an executive order, which the Republicans in a very political way took to the most anti-immigration judge they could find, who instantly deemed it unconstitutional, and so now it has to work its way through the federal courts.
Let me get John from Haddonfield to join our conversation. Hi, John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
We just hit on this a little bit in discussing the unprecedented intransigence of the Republican opposition to this president. The thing that it seems, you know, there's been some conversation of, you know, Obama doesn't have sufficient relationships with Congress, or he has failed to woo the Republican Party and build coalitions. And when you look at the words straight out of Republican leadership's mouth, Mitch McConnell, our main goal is reducing this president to a one-term president, which thankfully he failed at. There's been a system to delegitimize and deprive the president of any material gains and to render him a lame duck president from early on. So the analysis focusing on how recent gains may reframe the presidency, to me, sort of denies some of the history that's going on here. And just really quick, I know I'm going
well. You know
on,
what,
but-
John? Only because we have about a minute left, and I want to put your comment to Julian Zelizer. And we touched on this earlier, which is that he has faced stiff opposition in among Republicans in the Congress.
Yes, he has. It's not unprecedented. You know, Southern Democrats opposed civil rights with the same ferocity in the 40s and 50s that Republicans oppose a lot of domestic legislation today. And so the real question, I think, isn't could he schmooze more? Could he have done more to nurture Democrats in Congress and to try to strengthen their position back in 2010? And did he make mistakes on that front and in the coming years so that he could have had the kind of Congress in the Democratic sense that would work with him? And that's another issue we're going to have to study.
Ryan, 30 seconds. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that the biggest mistake was made when he pushed through a stimulus that was too small. He hoped that he could get a lot of Republican buy-in by throwing a lot of tax cuts and he negotiated very closely with Republicans, kept it lower than he otherwise could have gotten it. I know that there's some debate about this, but I covered this, you know, day in, day out, and I strongly believe that there was much more they could have done in terms of a jolt for the economy. And once they came through with that small stimulus, the 2010 wipeout was kind of baked in, and everything has kind of unspooled from there.
Well, we have to end on that note. My thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Ryan Grimm, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post. Julian, thank you very much as well.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. That's Julian Zelizer, Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program, how to download a podcast of the show, how to find us on Facebook, how to follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thanks so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.